Sweet. You weren't. Stuart was. You weren't here last week, were you?
I was.
Okay, cool. Well, what we're doing is we're going through the enemies of God's people. And it's not necessarily in like any chronological order. We're going to be skipping around a little bit. And last week I said something about it maybe being a 6 or 7 week class and then merging in with the theology class that Ken is teaching. But we've talked since then, and Tim thinks it's a good idea to go ahead and do the 13 weeks. So we're going to do it. Actually, we'll talk about next week at the end of the class. And so we have a little bit of a curveball for you. All right. So as we go through the different people groups, the nations that are in the Bible and how they interact with Israel, these are the sorts of questions that we'll be asking. You know, where do they come from? Where do they go? How were they organized or governed? What was their culture like? What did their religions look like? And how did they interact with Israel? And so from this, from understanding the context of the various nations, it helps us to understand those passages where Israel has contact with those folks. And it gives us depth that we can't possibly achieve without understanding something of these cultures and these nations. Okay. So last week we talked about the Canaanites, and this week we're going to talk about the Egyptians. Okay. Clearly we're not going to be able to teach everything about the Egyptians and the Israelites in an hour or 55 minutes or whatever. So we're going to break this class up. So we'll do, kind of the first part this week. We're not really going to get into much of the biblical text, the biblical contact with the Egyptians. We'll save that for next time. All right. So in studying the Egyptians, I used a combination of biblical sources or the biblical text and secular sources. And so there's a problem with secular sources, though, that's summed up in this one of the books that I was referring to, using as a reference. It says, using the Bible as a historical source should be done with extreme skepticism and ensuring corroboration with other sources, if possible, because, as Kurt noted, it is a complex, ideologically motivated compilation within which stories were refashioned to drive home particular lessons of the past. Okay? Now, think about what this guy's saying here. You may have two ancient sources. One of them is the Bible, and one of them is not the Bible. We can trust the ones that are not the Bible, but we can't trust the ones that are the Bible. What do you think about that? What would be the motivation for that? Why would they say such things? What's that? What is that? Higher criticism. What does that mean? Okay. So they think the Bible is from a primitive culture, right? But these other historical texts coming from other nations, they're also from quote-unquote primitive sources. So I look at a couple of things. One, were you going to?
Oh. It's like they don't want to say the whole Bible is true because then they have to kind of commit to like the whole Bible being true.
Great.
So you have this idea of like you can't take it completely as truth,
right?
Then we can dismiss all this other stuff that says we're sinners.
Great point. So if you take the Bible as historically accurate in fact, then you have to accept the moral implications of that and the authority of God. That's very well said. And then also going back to what Randy was saying is that we have this tendency to look back on cultures and think that we're smarter than them. Okay, especially those silly religious people, you know, or those pious Jews from, you know, 3,000 years ago. Okay, I do find it interesting though that they will trust other sources, and so I think I think there is a double standard, because if Assyrian texts or Egyptian texts, if all of these texts are trustworthy, there's no moral implications there. We don't have to change the way we live our lives. But if the Bible is historically accurate, then that means that God, you know, parted the Red Sea and God delivered the Egyptians out of Israel, or I'm sorry, out of Egypt. I said that backwards, didn't I? God delivered the Israelites out of Egypt. A man 2,000 years ago, in the form of God, was hanging on a cross, and he was resurrected from the dead. And, of course, that is a total game changer. Okay?
It's just human nature to attack what we don't agree with.
Right.
And to agree with what we believe.
Right. Yeah, we kind of, we'll go back and kind of find what we're looking for. Right.
You see it in modern day.
Mm-hmm. All the time.
Especially in politics.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they attack what they don't agree with.
And, yeah.
You know, they'll agree with somebody who shares their same belief, even though what they're saying is preposterous.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Did you guys, everybody hear that? We have the habit of essentially finding those whom we agree with and then believing them. So we don't, in other words, we don't want to change what we think. In one very short word, the fall. I guess that's two words. The fall. The fall corrupted every aspect of our being, including our intellect. And so we can never forget that when we're, as we're studying history, as we're studying philosophy or anything else. The fall impacted, it's called the noetic effects of sin. It's the effect of sin on the mind. Okay? There was as an example from the world of science, you've heard of the Big Bang, of course, right? Everybody's heard of the Big Bang. When that theory first came out in the early 20th century, there was a man named Fred Hoyle who, when he heard about it, he referred to it as the Big Bang. But that was a, it didn't have a really a word at that, or I'm sorry, a name at that point. But he called it the Big Bang in, as a derisive term, okay? And the problem that he had with it was that it sounded too much like God. It sounded too much like creation. Because the reason being is that it actually said that time had a beginning. The universe had a beginning. And he refused to believe that. And so he created, came up with, or conjured up, a alternative explanation for where the universe came from. And what he said was, as the universe expands, which is kind of the idea behind the Big Bang, as it expands, matter is continuously being created in the center of the universe. Now think about that for a minute. I know we have at least one engineer in the audience. You have this idea of creating matter, which is nonsense. You can think of the universe as a big closed system. That's which law is that? The first law of thermodynamics? Yeah. So actually, I think we have three engineers in the audience. So anyway, he basically sold his scientific soul in order to maintain a theory that would allow him to get around there being a God. Okay? So anyway, quite the rabbit trail, but we'll move on. So we'll move on now. Okay, let's talk about Egypt. So I guess I don't know how well you can see that, but the Egypt revolves around the Nile River. No Nile, no Egypt. Okay? It dominates Egyptian culture. And the idea here is that the Nile, it's so long and it covers essentially the entirety of Eastern Africa. The Nile River Basin covers the entirety of Eastern Africa. And the idea is all the waters from the torrential rains and things all collect within the Blue Nile and the White Nile as tributaries, and they flow into the Nile River proper. And then they go through Egypt. And what happens is every summer when these inundations come, the level of the river rises and then it goes down. So it's constantly going up and down. And so when it goes up, it floods the area directly surrounding the river. This is actually better at, it provides, it's better for the fertility of the area than just rain. Because it's actually bringing sediments and insects and all kinds of nutrients and things like that. It's washing all of those from all over Eastern Africa into that region and then depositing them into the soil on each side of the river. And then when the river goes back down, they're able to plant their crops, and these things grow crazy. And so you have this insanely fertile region going right up the Nile River. It may be the longest river in the world. It's either the Nile or the Amazon. It depends on who you ask. If you ask the Brazilians, it's the Amazon. It's kind of fascinating how they measure the length of a river. I watched a documentary on that not too long ago. Won't go into it here. The Nile has two major tributaries, the White Nile from the Sudan and the Blue Nile from Ethiopia. So you can see kind of that green ribbon going up through the desert, basically. And there are places along that little ribbon where you can stand on one side, kind of with your foot, one foot in the desert and one foot in the fertile area, and look across the Nile and see the desert over on the other side. And so it's very thin in some areas, and it's very broad in other areas. So anyway, Egypt originates biblically from, the first mention is in Genesis 10:6. Egypt was one of the sons of Ham, so he would have gone there from, the sons of Ham was Cush, Egypt, Put, and Canaan. And so after the dispersion, after the ark settled in on the mountain, then that's where the Egyptians would have come from. By more or less the time of Christ, Egypt had survived as an independent civilization for 3,000 years. It's so they've got a really long, long history. And then Rome conquered Egypt in 30 BC. Of course, it continued to survive as a people after that, long after that. It still survives to some extent today, but it was no longer really an independent nation at that point. It belonged to Rome, belonged to the Roman Empire. And Egypt is generally distinguished between the upper and the lower Egypt. So I'm sure you already know this, but the confusing part about the Nile is that it flows from south to north. And so upper Egypt is actually in the south, and lower Egypt is up in the north. And I've actually, preparing for this, gotten that backwards like three or four times. I just can't keep it straight in my mind. So these are the major eras, basically, of Egyptian chronology. We're not going to go into a lot of detail today, but we'll pick out some particular pharaohs next time. So if you look here, I don't know if you can see the color coding. The blue and the black are kind of fading together, but kingdoms occurred when the upper and lower Egypt were unified. And so there was relative stability. They had one pharaoh ruling over both upper and lower, and they referred to those as kingdoms. Then their intermediate periods are intervals of division or decentralization. In general, it's upper and lower Egypt would be separated. Dynasties are sub-intervals where the rulers shared a common origin. So there was something like 30 dynasties over the 3,000 years of Egyptian history. And the dates were pieced together and calculated based on how long the current pharaoh had been on the throne. So there was this guy, a priest in the 3rd century BC named Manetho, and he's our primary source for a lot of these dates. He went back to the documents and the monuments and things that he had access to. And he kind of pieced together this pharaoh reigned for this long and this pharaoh reigned for this long. And he came up with of course it didn't have our before Christ dates on it like we have, but he was able to kind of assemble a sequence. And then in later years they came back and actually put some dates on those. Herodotus, depending on who you ask, either the father of history or the father of lies, he's known by both, I think, equally. But he was the first detached historian in history. And he's also a major source of Egyptian history. Now, one of the interesting things about the dates is and I may go into this next time, there's a couple of different major ways to look at the dates. One is a called a high chronology and one is a low chronology. Because when you go back and you're putting 170 pharaohs in sequence, you have a little rooms for error in each one of those, and you begin to stack those errors. Well, one of the things they're able to do is look at maybe a writing that occurred, let's say, in the 30th or 40th pharaoh, and it's some astronomical event that occurred. Maybe Jupiter was in a particular position, or, you know, or something like that. And what they're able to do is, through astronomy, we're able to go back and reverse engineer when those events occurred, and so we can correlate the relative history of Middle Kingdom versus First Intermediate Kingdom versus this pharaoh was ruling, and correlate those with actual years relative to our calendar. Does it make sense? All right. Any questions so far? Yep.
What caused the division? Was it just somebody didn't like pharaoh, or
I don't really know? I think it probably varied, right? You know, different people, you're always going to ebb and flow. I mean, especially over 3,000 years, you know. I mean, we've only been around for a little over 200. We've already been divided once, you know. All right, so pharaoh means great house, and originally it referred to the palace that the ruler lived in. And then it came to mean actually the pharaoh himself or herself. The idea here also is, if you think about it, an analogy would be the president of the United States eventually becoming referred to as the White House. And we do that to an extent now. We say, according to the White House, da-da-da-da-da-da. Well, ultimately that comes from the president, right? So in the future, I don't know, if we're around for 3,000 years, maybe we'll refer to the president as the White House. Pharaoh was supposedly divine or semi-divine. He or she was thought to maintain the natural order, that is the annual flooding of the Nile. And so there were, and again, we're going to go into some details on some of this stuff later. but the idea here is that Pharaoh was kind of a connection with nature, and as a divinity, he had certain control over a lot of these things. And so there were daily and annual rituals that he would go through in order to ensure the sun going across the sky or the Nile flooding and subsiding. So since Pharaoh was thought of as divine, and since Pharaoh was responsible for the Nile, we see this interesting little verse in Exodus chapter 7, says, and the Lord said to Moses, see, I have made you like God to Pharaoh. Now, you can look at that, and if we're isolated from Egyptian history or Egyptian culture, we can kind of come up with ways of explaining that, because clearly Yahweh or God is not going to make Moses into a deity. You know, you don't, in the Christian world, in the real world, you don't go from mankind to deity. Right, you are either deity or you are not, and there happens to be one being that is deity. But if you think about what Moses did in disrupting the natural order, he really was making, in Pharaoh's eyes, making Moses out to be a god with the control over nature. He could do all these different things, and it was the sort of thing where it was almost like one god battling another, you know, in Pharaoh's mind. I think I already said this, but there were 170 pharaohs organized into 30 dynasties. So who was the last pharaoh? There's got to be a homeschooler out there that can answer this. Well, if I said, what was her name? Somebody said it. Cleopatra, right. She was the last pharaoh, and of course, we know about the deal with Rome in about 30 B.C. So, crowns of Pharaoh. I find this interesting in terms of being a symbol of Upper and Lower Egypt and their unity. You can see the white crown was Upper Egypt, and the lower crown was the white crown was Upper Egypt, the red crown was Lower Egypt. Then the double crown was a unified ruler. And then you've seen these before. Have you ever thought about what they mean? Randy's saying no, I've never thought about that. No? Okay. What do you think they mean, if you had to guess? Remember, we're talking about a God here. What's that? Go ahead. Excellent. Yes. Give the guy a PhD. The crook, or the shepherd's staff, represents Pharaoh as a benevolent and productive shepherd. Okay? And then the flail, that's the other thing, represents Pharaoh as a disciplined authority. So you can see kind of mercy and love, kind of that sort of thing, right? Very similar to the idea, only very different at the same time, from Psalm 23. So, David refers to your rod and your staff, they comfort me. So both your justice and mercy and wrath, as well as your mercy and grace, comfort me, which is exactly the way that we should look at Yahweh, but not so much as a mortal being. All right, so we talked about this somewhat, or actually quite a bit last week, and we've got some new people, so we're going to kind of go through this again in a little bit different, way. So we're going to talk about pagan metaphysics. Metaphysics is just a fancy word for saying the fundamental nature of reality. Okay. So this is the Christian view of the world, Christian view of reality. It's truth, right? You have a triune creator and you have creation. And those two, and there is a line in between those. And creation does not become the triune creator. Okay? Their beings are different. The one on top, the triune creator, his being is underived. In other words, he exists. He always has, always will. The creation hasn't always existed. Our being is derived from the creator. Does that make sense? All right. So the triune God is ultimate reality, the supreme, final, and fundamental power in all reality. Does it make sense? So if you're going to talk about reality in the Christian world, you're going to start with God. You're going to start with the triune God. Okay? Pagan religions, you can start in different places. He is both infinite and personal. Now that is a unique concept in all the history of the world and all the ideas that anybody's ever had. And of course, it didn't come from man. It came from God himself. But there are many religions, worldviews out there that talk about an infinite God who's not personal. Pantheism is a great example. You have the whole world is God, and to some extent it's infinite. It can be thought of as infinite, but it's not personal. It's like the Force in Star Wars, okay? Or you can flip it around and you can have a personal God like Zeus or Apollo, but they're not infinite, okay? God created the world and everything in it. That is, he created everything that is not him. That's a pretty simple statement. God is distinct from and independent of creation. In other words, he don't need nothing from nobody. Okay? He does not need us to love because he is tripersonal. He can love him, you know, he loves within himself, within the triune God. He does not need us for anything. But then you have this idea of Christ. You have, I don't know, the biggest miracle since the creation of creation itself, right? You have the triune God, this one of the members of the Godhead, entering into creation. Now, that's a scary little image for me there, because it's not an image of God, right? But in drawing this, I'm like, well, this doesn't really capture this part of it, or it doesn't capture that part of it. Well, guess what? We can never create anything that ever captures in totality what it means for Christ to enter into creation. Likewise, we can never create any kind of image or anything that actually captures who God is. And so that means that we should never create an image of God, because we are always corrupting him in some way, corrupting our understanding of him. And I think that was a big part of the motive for the first two commandments, or actually the second commandment. All right. Quick Christology here. So Jesus, as he entered into creation, he is fully divine, fully and completely divine. He is fully and completely human. The human and divine natures are distinct and without confusion. And the human and divine natures are completely unified in one person. Okay. So now this is the pagan view of reality. So you have these three circles: humanity, you have the gods, and you have nature. Then you notice you have arrows in between them. That's because you have that line. Here you don't have a line. You have fluidity between deity, humanity, and nature. And so if you think about it, in Greek mythology you have Hercules. Is Hercules God or man? Right? He's kind of 50-50, right? Not Christ. Christ is not 50-50. He's fully and completely human, fully and completely divine. But in the pagan world, you have these blends between the gods and humanity, and then between humanity and nature, and then nature and the gods. Now, one of the stories I told last week was about a month or so ago when Jan and I, when we were on a cruise with, I don't know, a whole bunch of you, and we went to the and saw the Mayan ruins in Mexico, in Cozumel. And when we went there, they had a, they talked about one of the pyramids that there, or one of the temples there, on top is where they would do the human sacrifices. And so when they sacrificed the human, when he or she died, it would go up and kind of hang out with the sun for a while, with the sun god. As the sun god went across the sky, this person would go up and be with the sun god for 5 days. And the tour guide talked about, you know, having conversations and I guess asking questions, you know, different things like that. And then after the end of the 5 days, the soul of the human would then come down and inhabit a hummingbird. And then for those reasons, the Mayans never would put a hummingbird in a cage because it was a human soul. Okay. So think about that. In one story, you've got the blurring between the human and the divine, and between human and nature, right? And so what that shows you is that all the pagan religions, mythologies, different things like that, they all have a commonality to them. And this is common. It doesn't matter if you're talking about North America or Central America or whatever, or if you're talking about the ancient Middle East, it doesn't matter. This generally holds true for all of these pagan pagan cultures. Yeah.
I really think it's so interesting how we often may try to imitate the triune nature of God.
Mm-hmm.
And it just reminded me of even in Revelation, we have the ultimate false Trinity.
Uh-huh.
And even those are spoken of coming from different places, like the dragon comes from heaven.
Yeah.
The beast comes from the sea, and the false prophet comes up from the earth.
Right.
Threes.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, I didn't make that connection, but you're right. You're absolutely right. And I guess riffing off of that, we can also think about false creation myths deriving from and corrupting the real creation story, what actually happened. So you can go to Gilgamesh, or you can look at Enuma Elish, or you can look at whatever. And these different stories will take truth and then corrupt it, and then it's always just a little bit changed, you know. So, yeah, good point. So why would a person confuse or conflate these three realms? Try to put yourself in the position of somebody walking around 3,000 years ago, 4,000 years ago, okay? you go out and you interact with nature, right? You interact with the weather. And sometimes it's storming. And so you're thinking, nature must be angry. And sometimes it's a beautiful sky and the flowers are out and birds are singing and all of that. And well, nature must be happy. And if it's raining and kind of dreary like in Seattle or something, well, nature must be sad. Okay. So you begin to connect emotions, human emotions. What we know, we project on to what we don't know. And by the way, that's one of the big dangers when we are thinking about God. We can't start with ourselves and project it onto God. We've got to take God, His revealed truth, and understand what He is telling us about Him. And then if we do say, God is kind of like this, we've always got to measure it against Scripture. Because when we don't do that, we end up with something called heresy. It's an untruth. It's a false teaching about God. So the pagans are like a, 4,000-year-old object lesson, I guess, for believers, for lack of a better explanation. So anyway, so they're projecting human personalities and human emotions onto nature. And then these begin to form. And they begin to kind of, you build on them and they begin to take a life of their own. And then you end up with a pantheon of gods. Well, then guess what? You have to explain where the gods came from. Now you need creation stories and things of that nature. So anyway, so we have these three realms, but a few minutes ago I said, anytime you're talking about the Christian world, you have to start with God, because God is ultimate reality, right? Here, there is no ultimate reality. There's no top. There's no starting point. Unless you want to say yourself is the starting point. Okay? So you have this idea of what one scholar refers to as the meta-divine realm. And again, I mentioned the Force in Star Wars. You can kind of think of the Force in Star Wars. It's this impersonal thing that keeps everything together. Okay? And it is ultimate reality in the pagan world. And it's amazing how many of these detached pagan religions have the same idea. Okay? A few notes about it is it's amoral. So it doesn't have an idea of good or evil. Okay? Think about the Force as a whole, right? You have the dark side and the light. What do they call the other side? What? Come on. Is it dark and light? Oh, it's dark and light. Okay. Sorry. You have Darth Vader and Luke Skywalker. I don't know. Good guys and bad guys. Well, take those together and you are, you're morally neutral, for lack of a better word. Okay. So the meta-divine realm doesn't take sides. Magic sought to manipulate the meta-divine realm in order to control the gods, humans, or nature. So if you take make a potion or speak a spell, then you are able to impact the meta-divine realm, which would in turn manipulate the gods or nature or humans. And so I'm having trouble breathing today for some reason. So you control the gods or nature or other humans. And so that would be the impact of magic. And so think about the Egyptians when they're trying to confront Moses, right? What are they doing? They're doing these spells and different things like that. They're actually not really trying to manipulate the gods directly. They're trying to appeal to the meta-divine realm, which would impact everything else. You can think of the magicians and Daniel is doing the same thing. Ritual was a demonstration of what the worshiper desired. And so you have this idea of Pharaoh would go out every morning and essentially do this ritual perform this ritual in order to ensure that the sun came up and went across the sky every day. And then yearly they did this thing, similar sort of thing with the Nile. And then myth accompanied the ritual in order to ensure the continuance of the cycle. So it's words that were being spoken that accompanied the ritual that ensured that things would continue. And that's one thing to bear in mind about the pagan world is everything is cyclical. Okay. Whereas the Christian understanding of time is that it's linear. It's going forward, right? It's headed somewhere. With the pagans, you're not really going anywhere. You're just in a cycle. And that's one of the things that motivated the idea of karma. So pagan cosmogony, all right? Cosmogony is just a fancy word for explanation of where the world came from. All right. Yes, sir. Right.
Well, the cause must be that I've upset the God.
Right.
And whereas with someone who is nothing bad happens to them,
right.
Their circumstances, and they look at, well, they must be making the God happy.
Right.
That many of the rituals came about probably because, oh, well, I cut myself and I spilled some blood and there's some good things happen. Therefore,
right.
Just so, like you talked about last week, the veil, as they're cutting themselves, they think that's what's going to make the veil happy. And so the
absolutely. Yep.
And so I think much of what the rituals came from was dealing with pain and death.
Yep.
Because they don't have any other answers for it.
Yep. And that's a great, great point. And where do we see this idea of kind of appeasing the gods and thinking that because things are going wrong in my life, I must have ticked off a god? Where do we see that? Yeah, consistent. The big one, though, would be Job with his friends. Of course, he didn't believe that because he knew the one true God, right? You can read about it, in Habakkuk, and then throughout when it talks about the pagans or just even human understanding. That's one of the things about the Bible, specifically the Old Testament, as well as the Gospels, too, is we have to differentiate between there's truth, and then there's a human, corrupted human understanding of the truth, right? So the Pharisees, as an example in the New Testament, they were, they believed that you had to kind of work your way into heaven or work your way into staying in the covenant, right? A works religion, a works-based religion. Well, that's never what the Old Testament was about, right? They misunderstood the teachings of the Old Testament. We've never been saved by works. We've always been saved by grace through faith. Okay, Abraham believed God, and what? It was counted to him as righteousness. It wasn't that Abraham did this or that, right? And so that's one of the things we have. When we read Job's friends, you know, they are so dangerous to read. I mean, I'd say the Bible's dangerous to read, but the book of Job's dangerous to read, and I struggle with quoting it because are these the misconceptions? Is this a misconception or is this a truth? And so, you know, when you have conversations like that, and so you can, you know, even like Jeremiah, you know, Jeremiah was praying, you know, God, why do you hate me? You know, why do you make all these things happen? And in reality, God didn't hate him. Right. All right. I forget where I was going with that, but I think it's a good point anyway, so we'll just leave it. Yeah. Right.
So, like, even when the disciples were with Jesus, and they're like, why is this man blind? Like, was it his man or was it his punishment? Because it was just common, regardless of where the teaching originated.
Yep.
And he was like, he's blind because I'm going to show my glory through him.
Right. Right.
Always and is always going to be for God's glory.
Right.
So
And you just touched on something that is so profound.
That's what I do.
Yeah, that is what you do. I heard that about you. No, let me tweak what you just said, though. Mankind looks at something that looks at a prior cause of suffering, right? So we look, what did this person do in order to suffer, right? As a Christian, where do we look? We look forward to what's the goal of the suffering, right? And so mankind is always backward looking for a cause, but God is forward looking. You don't suffer unless there's a reason going forward that's going to glorify Him, right? And that's essentially what you said, right? Just moving the words around a little bit, making it Twitterified, I guess. All right. Any other questions? Those are great comments, by the way. All right. Four types of cosmogonies. What's a cosmogony? Explanation of where the world came from. Excellent. All right. So the first is you have a, and you just came in. We're not teaching any kind of weird heresy here. This is, we're talking about Egypt. Oh, okay. Okay, great. These are pagan cosmogonies, basically. Okay. So you have the idea of pre-existent matter.
Where did
okay.
that come from?
That's a great question. Where'd Plato say it came from? It was eternal. So the idea is that you have a God and matter living side by side, right, in all eternity. Okay? And then, of course, that begs all kinds of questions, but Stuart touched on it. Where did the matter come from? So normally it's this matter is some kind of chaos that needs to be ordered and organized. Most often the primordial stuff, this pre-existent matter, is depicted as the sea. Now why do you think that is? What, again, set your mind back 3,000 years. There is the flood, but the ocean is a big scary thing. Right? And most ancient peoples weren't necessarily that seafaring. And so you look out in the ocean or you find yourself in the ocean and it's some scary stuff. Okay? And so the idea would be this primordial, stuff would often be an ocean. Then there's conflict. The Creator God battles a personification of chaos. So it's a similar sort of thing. But instead of chaos just being this stuff, like a big wad of chewing gum, it actually has personality. And more often than not, the primordial chaos is personified as a sea monster. Now, we talked months ago about Enuma Elish, which was a Babylonian creation myth. And in there, you had essentially two sea monsters. You had Tiamat, and you had Apsu. And Tiamat represented chaos. So you have this idea of chaotic primordial matter. Generally, the body of the dead monster is used to create the world. So you have conflict, you have the slaying of the monster, and then, like in the Enuma Elish, they took Tiamat's body, and part of her made the heavens and part of her made the earth. Kind of weird. Then there's sex. A god and his goddess engage in sexual intercourse. And of course, other gods are created. The earliest gods are more abstract. The later ones tended to be more practical. So the earlier gods tended to be things like chaos or non-existence or these really weird abstract things. But as they moved on, they became things like the god of justice, the god of war, god of this or that. And then you had the god of thunderstorms and the god of the sea and things. And then finally again, we're talking about pagan mythologies here. The spoken word, the god brings everything into existence by manipulating the meta-divine realm vocally. Does that sound like Genesis? Who said that? Hey, good answer. I like you. It doesn't, because a God does not, in Genesis, there is no meta-divine realm. God is ultimate reality, not a meta-divine realm. And that is a huge difference. It's similar to, you know, you can look at real gold and you can look at fool's gold. And on the surface, they're the same. But that's where it ends. Molecularly, everything else is completely different. And one is valuable and one is not. One is true and one is not. And so that's a lesson for us, is that we can look at other religions, other belief systems, and see these artificial, superfluous similarities. But when you dig down into them, they are radically different, a radically different basis of reality. The Mormons will say that they worship the same God we do. They say that they're Christian. No, they worship a created being. If that's the only difference, full stop, that's not Christianity. Okay? So this idea that if you go back and you read scholars that talk about spoken word or creation by fiat, it is not the same thing as Genesis. Okay? We're kind of running out of time. So I'm going to flip. I think we can do lessons learned. And then we'll pick up, actually, in 2 weeks on the Egyptian stuff. All right. So we didn't cover that. Isn't it understandable that mankind, left to his imagination, will confuse the realms of deity, humanity, and nature? Right? If you put yourself back in their place, and again, left to yourself, without divine revelation, you can definitely see where people would come up with these ideas. Okay? And think about the belief that the world was stationary and that the rest of the universe kind of revolved around it, revolved or rotated, whichever it is. You can see where they came from. You can see why they would believe that, because the earth doesn't really move unless you live like around earthquakes, right? It's really stable and everything else seems to revolve around you. So from their perspective, it made all the sense in the world. Okay. You see how an inanimate entity like the Nile could be deified. Why would they deify the Nile? What's that? Yeah, they're looking at it as a source of life. If the Nile doesn't do what it needs to do every year, then they're going to die of starvation. Or they're going to have some really, really bad times ahead, famine and things of that nature. Somebody say something? Oh, famine, yep. You see kind of how history repeats itself. And what I mean by that is think of some of the more modern ideas that we have out there that are really reincarnations, if you will, of past heresies or past false creation myths and things of that nature, right? What does Solomon say in Ecclesiastes? There's nothing new under the sun. Yeah, there's no false religion that's new under the sun. You can look at the New Age stuff, and it goes back thousands of years to heresies. Yeah. Yes, sir?
There's a great book on this by a guy named Louis Marcos.
Okay.
It's called Atheism on Trial. That does exactly this. It goes back 2,000 years.
Yep.
And says, look, we're seeing the same things now as they dealt with back then.
Yep. Yeah, and Philip Marcos?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, excellent. Louis Marcos, okay. That's a good point. And then you mentioned atheism, and it'll be interesting to watch, you know, these new atheists, Christopher Hitchens is dead, Daniel Dennett, Sam Harris, and Richard Dawkins. These sorts of guys. It'll be interesting to see how they and their followers evolve over time, right? Think about Carl Sagan. What did Carl Sagan believe about God? What would you say his religion was? Remember Carl Sagan? All that exists is the world. Okay, it's all, or the cosmos is all that ever was or is or will be. Okay? Everybody thinks Carl Sagan was an atheist. But when you talk to his son said that he was a pantheist. Okay? He said things like, he talked about the spirit of the universe. He essentially believed in the same God as Albert Einstein. He knew that something was kind of out there, but he didn't really understand what it was. And that's where these new atheists are going as well. Okay? Because atheism has no explanation for humanity, really. It has no moral grounds. It has no purpose. It has no meaning. And so what do? You have to create those yourselves, right? So Sam Harris, a devout atheist, wrote a book on the scientific grounds for morality. And he ended up just talking himself into circles. Okay? So atheists end up in a very bad place where they're forced to create, guess what? Their own myths. And they end up repeating the pagan myths of the ancient world. Oh, that's it. Guess that's it. All right, any last questions? Okay, so we're doing the enemies of God. Next week is a little bit different. Tim will be substituting. Jan and I are going to visit Danny up in Dallas, and Andy is going to a conference up there, some model-making thing. I'm not sure what it is. Anyway, we're going to go. We'll be gone next week, and so Tim's going to step in and substitute, and he's going to do kind of all the passages associated with Satan, because I'm definitely thinking we can consider Satan an enemy of God's people, right? Okay. And then I guess in 2 weeks I'll be back, and then I'll finish up Egypt. And what we're going to do here is we'll go through what they believed about the creation of the world, what they believed about where man came from, and then we're going to connect a lot of that with specific Bible passages. And we're going to try to make all of that in 1 week. I'm not sure if we'll make it, though. All right? Cool. Any last questions? Anything? Nope. Tim, do you mind closing us?
Thank you, sir.